Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Charlie, and you're listening to a very special episode of Hometown Glory. I'm today joined by one of the UK's very best screenwriters. He's written movies including The Ritual, My Days of Mercy, I, Boy, and the newly released Encounter, which is available to watch on Amazon Prime Video right now. He's written for TV shows including Beaver Falls, Humans, Our World War, Troy, Fall of a City, and one of my favourite shows of the last decade, Giri Haji. He's also got a few disgustingly exciting projects in the pipeline that I'm going to quiz him on in just a little while. He is, of course, Joe Barton. And Joe, welcome to Hometown Glory. It's so nice to talk to you today. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Charlie. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. How are you doing in the run-up to Christmas? How's everything on your end?
It's all sort of fine, man. I think I've got almost all the presents I need to get. I've had my food delivery. I've got some work I still need to be doing, but I'm like almost there.
Good. I saw you on Twitter talking about wrapping presents, which sort of put the fear of God in me as I remembered that is yet to come. Are you a good rapper?
No, I'm not particularly. I sort of and I forget every time I have to do it, and I can do, like, I can wrap a book, do you know what I mean? Like, I could, like, it's like a simple shape, but as soon as you throw anything like a mug or just any sort of slightly, like, if it's not an oblong, I'm not rapping it. I'm not rapping it. Well, no, but we did a whole sort of rapping day yesterday. We watched the Lord of the Rings movies because for some reason I just find them very Christmassy. I don't know why, sort of trying to regressing to sort of childhood status or something. But yeah, we did a whole rapping day, watched some Hobbits. It was great.
Did you watch, which ones did you watch? All three of the Lord of the Rings ones?
Didn't actually make it the Hobbit trilogy. We watched the first two. So we watched Fellowship and Two Towers. Oh, okay. We didn't finish the Two Towers. They're long, man. Those films are like 4 hours long. So we were doing extended editions.
I was going to say, your kids are in for a very nice Christmas if you got through two whole Lord of the Rings films.
Yeah.
I want to say congratulations on Encounter. I watched a couple of weeks ago and was just gripped throughout the entire thing. You must be thrilled by the responses, Scott. The reviews have been terrific.
Thanks, man. It's got, yeah, there's been some really nice ones. It's like with anything, I think you get a range. It was nice that Mark Kermode liked it. And I'm a fan of his. I slightly moaned at him on Twitter. Like, I didn't, like, I passive aggressively. He like tweeted, he tweeted a nice thing about the film and he called it Michael Pearce's Encounter. Michael Pearce is the name of the director. And you know, when you don't think someone's going to see your tweet. So I like quote tweeted him. I was like, oh, I wish like critics would stop like crediting the directors. And he's really nice. He like came back and like apologized and he's like mentioned it twice on Wittertainment and stuff. I obviously just looked, I felt really bad. I felt like I was being really sort of grumpy and like a dickhead to him. But yeah, it was like, he liked it and you know, Empire magazine and stuff like that. So yeah, no, man, it's good. It's been nice.
I know keeping that film particularly spoiler free is really important, but give our listeners a little sort of elevator pitch for the film if you can.
Okay, it's about a man played by Riz Ahmed, Malik, who absconds with his estranged children that he hasn't seen for a while, warning them that there's an extraterrestrial threat that he has to protect them from, and takes them on a road trip across America. And that's really all I can say. If it gets too twisty.
I would have stopped you in your tracks had you said any more, because I think it's a film that you need to watch yourself, and almost on, you know, just read the lovely positive stuff. Don't read too much about the plot, because it's a film that unfurls itself in a really quite surprising, pretty beautiful way. Actually, I wasn't expecting the way that the father-son relationships, particularly, I thought was written really, really beautifully. So congratulations on that, Joe. Also, tell me a little bit about Giri Haji. I have to ask, because as I said at the top, it's one of my wife and I have just been rewatching it. And I was saying to you before we jumped on, before we started recording, just how well that series stands up on a second watch. It's absolutely incredible TV. Tell me, is there any chance of it coming back and with another network? Or it seems to be like one of those series that people have held so close to their hearts. And I know online there's always a sort of buzz anytime that you mention it, and people have speculated as to what a second season could look like. I mean, I think I saw you once talk about a sort of tacky Rodney spin-off, which would be spectacularly wonderful. Like all these amazing things could happen. And I know we're going to go on to all the incredible things you've also got lined up. So, you know, free time isn't particularly something you're flush with at the minute, but is there any chance that it could get revived at some point?
I don't think so, man. I think it's really dead, which is like heartbreaking, because I really loved it. And I was really proud of it. And it was one of those sort of amazing experiences where it was sort of like, I mean, sometimes you can enjoy working on something and the end product not be, you know, that great or anything, but it was one of those ones where it was such a sort of life-changing experience to make. And then the final, you know, we were all just really proud of how it, you know, how it turned out as well. And yeah, we were all very we were gutted. It got cancelled quite quickly. Then I just don't think it ever quite took off on Netflix. I mean, Netflix were like, because it's a co-production between Netflix and BBC, they tend not to sort of push their resources into those as much as their sort of pure originals. So it kind of sort of fell between the cracks, which is, you know, it happens. Not every show can be Squid Game or Bridgerton or like one of these sort of breakout successes. And unfortunately it just didn't get the numbers. So I don't think it will come back. But the other day, I don't know, I did look at like the, because we had the whole second series planned. And maybe just to torture myself, I sort of found the document. I was like, I'm trying to remind myself of what we were going to do. And it was, it would have been good. I think it would have been really good. But yeah, it will exist only in my in my mind.
Why do you think it, I mean, well, let's forget the numbers. Why do you think, for a lot of people, myself included, why do you think people sort of have held it so close and people have latched onto it? And it seems to have this sort of long tail with people discovering it and getting really, really into it. Why do you think that is?
I think it's probably the characters, I think, were well drawn and well brought to life. I mean, ultimately the thing we did was we essentially smuggled in a arty kind of character drama under the guise of a crime thriller, and then we sold it essentially as a Yakuza sort of London-based, you know, crime mob show, and it starts with all these murders and there's like a big, there's a thing that needs to be solved, you know, but we quite sort of quickly did away with it, and I think people, and then people I've spoken to anyway, that, you know, that everyone always has a character that they particularly sort of latch onto, or a group. It's essentially a found family show, essentially about these lost characters that come together and form a little unit. And I think that is something that people always respond really well to, because I think, I don't know whether, you know, we all have our groups, whether it is our actual family or our friends or people that we've, you know, you know, held on to, or football teams or whatever, you know, little our little clubs and families and places that we sort of are drawn to. And I think that's kind of what the show is about. So I don't know. I think maybe it's that. People just like the like the gunfights, maybe. I don't know. It's that weird thing of like you try and recreate something that's been successful, but you're never entirely sure what the sort of magic ingredient is. You just have to try and, you know, try and replicate it.
One question I had for you: which Spurs player is Kenzo and which is Yuto, do you think?
Oh man. Well, okay, so Kenzo, he's very he's outwardly conservative and sensible, but has an inwardly is a dark secret and is capable of completely sort of blowing everything up himself. He's quite like secretly anarchic but outwardly sensible. Who would that be? It's like sort of a Hoiberg or something. He's sort of like a central defensive midfielder, but also like an insane one. Like I'm trying to think who we've had. He's like
I was thinking Hugo. He was mine. Okay. You know, that sort of stoic kind of leader, yeah. Puts everyone on his back, but you know, has a certain a darkness to him. Perhaps,
has a man like when he attacks Son. Yeah. I love that bit in the All or Nothing documentary. There's that bit where they basically, the team get told off for being too nice, and they were like, you have to, you know, put more in and be nastier. And their reaction to that was Hugo like screaming at Son at halftime, and then Eric Dier basically kicked, like, I think injured Son. But so like their reaction to be, let's kick the nicest guy on the team, fuck him up. Maybe Kenzo would be Hugo. Yuto would be like, he's a sort of young, out of control, kind of does whatever he wants. Who would that be at the moment? Who have we got? Regulon? I don't know. Maybe that's unfair on him. He's like sort of, he is an agent of chaos. Like everything he does essentially makes things worse. So he's Sanchez. I don't know.
Sanchez, yeah, maybe like Tongi, perhaps, but yeah. I feel like he's maybe a bit too kind of high energy for like Yuto's a bit too high energy for Tongi, perhaps. I can't see Tongi being kind of generally asked to do half the things that Yuto does. It will seem like too much like hard work. So perhaps not there. Yeah. Maybe Davinson's the one. Poor old Dav. And I was going to ask you, to tell me a little bit about upcoming projects as well. But about 10 minutes before we started chatting, I was reading on the Hollywood Reporter about celebrating your 2021 and looking ahead to 2022. And I feel like this sort of captures all the exciting things that you've got coming up there. So I'm going to just read from it. It was 2021 in which he suddenly seemed to transform into one of Hollywood's most in-demand writers and become headline news, with a flurry of major announcements at the start of the year, seeing him tapped to lead the writing team for HBO Max's upcoming The Batman spin-off set in the Gotham Police Department, and pen J.J. Abrams' Cloverfield sequel for Paramount. A seemingly ridiculously busy January on the news front also found time to have Barton's eight-part action thriller Extinction, starring I May Destroy You, breakout Papa Residue, greenlit by Sky just a month after Netflix announced his adaptation of YA book series Half Bad, which he's exec producing with Andy Serkis. Joe, I mean, what the Christ.
Yeah, man, there's some exciting stuff going on. That was like last January, I think, that everything got announced at once. There was like a week where I was just putting all these stupid projects on Twitter, and I figured, you know when you've got like, you can be happy for someone for like up to a certain point, and then I was like, just like texting me like, stop it. It's been a nice, well, it was a good year in terms of getting stuff off the ground, and it's been very busy. it was really fun like telling everyone about these projects, and then I've had like 12 months of working on them. It's been exhausting, but that's all well. So we've got the Extinction, which is actually, we've had to change the title of that because some mad fucking guy is like, there's this guy who's written his own script called Extinction. He's like this ex-banker that lives in Switzerland. He wants to be a writer. He's trademarked the title. He's threatened to sue him. So we've changed it to, it's going to be called The Lazarus Project, which we haven't announced yet. but that's an exclusive. I don't know if we're supposed to talk about it. But I don't think I'm thinking about it. But that's, yeah, so that's a sort of time travel action thriller that's going to be on Sky. And I think that's going to be in like, yeah, March or April or something like that. We're just in the mix on that at the moment, which is, yeah, and that's really exciting. Yeah, Papa's the star of it. He's amazing. I mean, just for you and all of these things that he's done. He's just like sort of, we were so excited to get the chance to work with him. And he's, yeah, he's just like magnetic, man. He's great. But we've got a great cast of that. Anjali Mahindra is in it. And we've got Tom Burke. Tom Burke's playing a character called Rebrov, which is my top them reference in the series, playing this villain called Rebrov. So yeah, so that would be cool. And then we've got Half Bads coming out on Netflix, which is like a sort of it's like a sort of YA book adaptation about witches that live in Britain, sort of slightly younger skewing, but that's actually really fun. We've just been starting to put those episodes together. Now, only wrapped recently, had our wrap party on the beginning of December, which turned into a bit of a super spreader event, unfortunately. Coronavirus, okay. But yeah, so that's good. I'm really excited about that as well. And then, yeah, man, Batman spinoff and Cloverfield and all that stuff, which is, you know, I mean, anything like, you know, we'll see what happens with the, and if these big projects in Hollywood, you could be doing, you know, you they can all be going well and they'll fall apart, or that you get fired or something will happen. But at the moment, it's all great. And I'm really, yeah, it's quite surreal. It's been quite a surreal year doing all that writing.
I can imagine. Are you going to have to go out to LA and do all that sort of fun stuff at some point?
I guess so, yeah. I didn't obviously this year because of everything that's been going on. But I've only ever been out there once. I was out there just before COVID really kicked off. But I haven't been back since. But I guess, yeah, we maybe have to. They keep sort of talking about the, you know, the Batman show, whatever happens with it, like if we get it going, whether that was shooting London or New York or Pittsburgh or something. So I'm like curious to know where I have to go and live somewhere else. Maybe I don't know how it would work, but we'll see.
And I mean, these are projects where, and I know Giri Hadji was obviously a very much a sort of showrunner situation, but that, talk to me a little bit about that difference between writing something and kind of handing off your baby, if you like, to all these sort of big film producer types and having to sit back and see what they do with it, as opposed to that responsibility on your shoulders as a showrunner. Which do you prefer for a start? I probably know the answer, but which one?
I prefer having creative control.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of the name of the game, I think. Every project's different. There's a massive difference between doing TV and film. That for me is the bigger difference, rather than necessarily the, you know, whether it's a Hollywood project or a British project or whatever. You know, TV versus film. As a writer in TV, you're sort of expected to be more creatively, you know, involved. So, you know, something like, you know, Giri or any of these other sort of TV shows, that, you know, I write them, and I sometimes get other writers on as well, but as you write them, you know, and then you'll be involved in like casting, hiring directors, you'll be in the edit, you'll be talking to composer, all this stuff. But in film, it's like you write it and then you just hand it over and then you're gone. It's like this, it's a weird system, which I don't think is entirely sort of, I don't think it's entirely beneficial for the final product, both in the way that I think directors and TV get slightly sort of, they don't get the credit they deserve, but they still creatively involved. Certainly in film, I think I've certainly been in positions where I've written films and been like, I feel like I should still be involved, right? You guys should like still ask me stuff, but
hence your Mardy tweets to Commode.
Fucking exactly. Hence my Mardy tweets to Commode. Although, but you know, and to be fair, he's kind of got a point. Like I would say, like Michael Pierce's Encounter, like there was certainly a point where I worked on that fucking script for like 8 years, and then Michael came on, and I was like, I didn't need me anymore. You know, I wasn't involved in like anything from that point, which is, you know, I have opinions on, but it's kind of just the way the industry works. It's baffling. But so like something with the Cloverfield movie, it's totally fine because you kind of go into it with your eyes open. Like it's like a massive, you know, no one's going to be going to see that film because I really happy to go in and, you know, you meet JJ Abrams, you write your script and you give it to them. And if they like it, great. And if it happens, great. Like I've done my job, you know. It's not like, this sort of, you know, you're not, it's not like, I haven't been like working on this since I was like 18 years old. It's not like my story, blah, blah, blah. It is what it is. And you go with your eyes open, and I like that process. But if it's like a sort of more sort of, I don't know, like something that you're more sort of strongly connected to, it can be difficult letting it go if it's a film, certainly. Yeah.
Before we dive into our Spurs questions, Joe, I wanted to talk to you just about the real diversity of your writing. Is something that really impresses me. And I was talking to my wife about this, and you know, she was pointing out, you know, you've written queer stories, you've written stories about, you know, people in the military, the sci-fi stuff. There's, you know, stuff about different types of culture, different cultures. I take it, taking that, you know, that real diversity of storytelling is something really, really important to you. You don't want to just be, you know, telling the same story or a story that's, you know, your story, if you like. You want to be looking outward into the world, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I like doing different, yeah, I like telling different stories, either whether you're sort of working different genres, or also, like you say, like whether it's about the characters that you're telling the story through, or where it's set, or any of these things. I think it's a really interesting, it's like a bit of a tightrope, because you can definitely, on the one hand, I don't think anyone sort of expects you to just, I should just write stories about like 36 year old white men with two kids who support Tottenham or whatever, because that's like ridiculous. But at the same time, you know, something like with Giri Hadji, obviously it was London, most predominantly I think London set, but obviously there's Japanese elements to it, and we filmed in Tokyo and we had lots of Japanese characters. And I think it's interesting kind of finding your way through that. And the same with like My Days of Mercy, which is LGBT story about two women who fall in love. And you've got to sort of, on the one hand, yeah, there's sort of the creative license to explore worlds that aren't your own. But at the same time, you are telling other people's stories, and you are sort of treading on ground that isn't necessarily, that you're not necessarily as sort of familiar with. And especially, I think, as sort of straight white guy sort of writing, you know, taking up a lot of place in the industry, I think you do have to be careful. And I definitely, you know, someone like Giri, I think you there are probably things we would have done differently now, or things we wouldn't do. But it's, yeah, I think it's, I'm interested in sort of as wider sort of range of people as possible. But I think it's there's always like a really interesting conversation about who gets to write what, and who takes up what space and all that stuff, which I think is an ongoing conversation. But I know people that write very, you know, I just do horror movies, or I just do like action movies and stuff. It's like, there's nothing wrong with that. It's not for me. I'd like to try and, you know, do as wide a range as possible if I can.
Have you felt that evolution in the last couple of years? You mentioned, you know, perhaps if you were tackling Giri now going into 2022, you'd do things differently. Have you felt that in a really sort of pertinent way, those changes and being hyper aware of having to be, you know, aware of a lot of different compelling things?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's sort of a fast growing or fast evolving industry in that way. And, you know, it, in terms of how, I think even just like in the last 5 years, or even at the beginning, when, you know, when Giri got greenlit to when we actually handed it in, I think the kind of the world had changed, and the industry had changed. I think people are, it's sort of, I don't know, people are sort of becoming more aware, or more sort of open to ideas that weren't there before. There were increasing sort of schemes, but just the sort of the idea of actually, well, who is, you know, who's working in this, you know, have we got enough women, enough gay people, enough people of color, enough, you know, differently abled people, all of these questions. It has been, there's been something of a reckoning with, I think, a lot of industries, but certainly creative industries. And it is, you know, it is a fast moving sort of environment at the moment. Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. Right. Let's change gears a little bit and talk about our world famous Spurs 7 questions now, Joe. I'm very excited to hear your answers to these. Question one. And quite fittingly for a DC showrunner, this question, your Spurs origin story, please. Yeah. How did you end up with this ridiculous football team on your back?
I was about 6 or 7, and I wanted to get into football. Like, I was just sort of starting to get interested in it. And we had I watched like Italia, Football Italia or something was on Channel 4, and I started to get like aware of it. And I was looking for a team to support. And I don't know, for whatever reason, I didn't just choose my local team, which would have been Crystal Palace at that time. And I remember going to like my dad and being like, what team should I support? And he sort of did that thing of like, he's trying to be helpful. He's not into football at all, but he was just like, well, just whoever you want. So I was like, okay, well. So the first ever game I watched was the 1992 European Cup final between Denmark and Germany, which Denmark won. And for a while, I just tell people I was a Denmark fan because that was like, well, I'll just support Denmark. But that didn't. That was impractical. So I needed a domestic team. And so I was sort of going on this like sort of journey, like trying to find who, you know, what sort of team sort of spoke to me. And my cousin lent me that he had this video of Italia 90. Like sort of VHS of like a recap of the whole tournament. And the moment that really grabbed me was the semi-final with the Gazza gets his yellow card and he's crying. And is that moment where Lineker does that, like watch him does that to, you know, to the bench. And there was something about that moment, like between these two men, and there's no football being played at that moment, do you know what I mean? But it was something about it. It was like the camaraderie and the love and the tragedy of it all, and this sort of glorious tragedy and sort of failure, but also this sort of brilliant, glorious failure. The whole thing, there's so many sort of narratives going on in that moment. And it just really sort of gripped me, and so I was like, who are these two guys? Like, who are Lineker and Gazza? And I think even at that point, maybe they had both moved on from Tottenham or were just about to move on from Tottenham. But I had sort of asked around, obviously, like pre-internet and that, and someone was like, oh, they're Spurs players or whatever. And I sort of looked, and I then found Tottenham on again another VHS video. My cousin's a Liverpool fan, he lent me the like Liverpool 1989-90 season. And I looked for Tottenham on that video, and I think I don't know if it's like 2-2, I'm sure they beat us, but I can't remember. But it was honestly, man, something about seeing that team, just even in those brief clips, I was like, yeah, this is it. This is the one for me.
I mean, I think Italia 90 was my sort of gateway into football, and my dad's not a Spurs fan, he's a Millwall fan actually, but my mum sort of banned my brother and I from ever doing the Millwall thing, so I had to go looking for a team, and it was exactly that sort of Gazza, Lineker. And it's amazing, isn't it, that moment that you described, that sort of glorious tragedy, you know, coming so close but failing in such like remarkable circumstances, has ended up, you know, pretty much defining as men of, you know, supporters of a certain age, it's basically been our experience of Spurs since that point.
Yeah.
That getting so close, failing in the most like preposterously tragic, ridiculous circumstances that really has also probably armed us for life in quite a useful way, perhaps.
Yeah, it's created a hardened shell. Yeah, but no, it's true, man. Little did I know that would be that would be it for life, that feeling of, oh, shit.
And who's your favourite player of all time, Joe?
Favourite player of all time? I sort of bounce around from different ones for a while. You know, sometimes like players just sort of, for whatever reason, like you just really takes them. I was a big Nico Crenshaw fan. I really liked him, and for a long time I was a big sort of Defoe guy. But to be honest, I think it's probably got to be Bale. I mean, it's a bit like saying like the Beatles are your favorite band, aren't you? But I just think there was just that moment. I remember I'm much more of a sort of armchair fan, suppose, but I remember seeing him live in like I think it was like pre-season and friendly against like Leighton Orient or something, and you know, before he'd sort of kicked on, and there was just something instantly you sort of saw this guy, something about him, and that sort of narrative, which is a little sort of similar to Harry Kane in a way, and like he had that whole sort of, he couldn't, you know, he wasn't in the winning team for like 200 games or something ridiculous. And then he just exploded, you know, and he was just this, you know, incredible, mercurial figure. And, you know, he just gave you some of those, there were some of the best moments. And, you know, that hat trick, you know, Milan and Taxi for Michael, and all these things, you know, the goal against West Ham and a volley against Stoke. And yeah, man, he's just such a brilliant, purely enjoyable player to watch that he sort of intimately sort of tied in with some of the greatest sort of modern sort of memories of the club. And then of course, you know, he left, and that was very sad. And that, for that, again, it's that, you know, when players you love leave, I think that's also, like, for some reason that also always sticks with you as a fan almost as much. You know, I remember Berbatov leaving, or Keane leaving twice, you know, and Bale going, these players, and I just remember being so sort of tied up in, you know, him and his identity. Anyway, and then he came back, and it was, you know,
weird.
It was weird, yeah. Really weird.
Sort of. I mean, I feel like, you know, we as Spurs fans, we're also completely, we're real suckers for the glorious return. Of course, that's part of our sort of makeup, I think. But yeah, having him come back, but no one sort of being there to see it, was just agonizing.
Ridiculous. Yeah. It felt very Tottenham in a way. It was like, even the way that, remember, you sort of knew he'd come back, but then the club just went silent for like a day. And you were like, oh no, something's happened. It's fallen through. And I just remember just being like refreshing Twitter for like 24 hours. And the whole thing was just fast. And then he was injured for like 2 months, and he'd come on, and oh man.
And then do you remember when he did come on, came on for the first time, it was that West Ham game.
It felt like it was
cursed. I don't know, it was such a mad time. I always think though that period, that those couple of days where it went from being a sort of Twitter rumor to gathering credibility to actually, oh my God, this is going to happen.
Yeah.
I will always hold those, and I think this is a very Spurs thing to actually like treasure memories of a rumor coming to fruition, perhaps over actual on pitch stuff. But that was like a weirdly magical time. Maybe because also like we were, I can't remember which lockdown we were perhaps in or not in, or whatever the fuck was going on. But to have something like that felt so magical actually happen, I will always remember.
Yeah, weirdly. It was a bit of good news in a very bleak time. Yeah.
Anyway. Let's move on. Bale's your favourite player of all time. Good. Got that one in the bag. This question is probably my favourite one. Your favourite terrible Spurs player.
So my answer, I feel like I might be being slightly unfair to this guy, because I don't think he's a terrible player, and he's had a reasonably successful-ish career, but it didn't work for him with us. And I, for a long time, really, really, really believed that this guy was just going to fucking unlock everything for us. And no one else thought this, but it was just me, I think. But Giovanni Dos Santos. I was like, oh, we got him from Barcelona. He's like this quick, like he's skillful. I was just like, fucking guy's going to be great. This guy's going to be absolutely fucking great. And he wasn't. I never lost faith. I never lost faith in him. You know, we loaned him to, you know, Ipswich. I don't know, somewhere else in Spain. If we brought him back now, there's a part of me that would still be like, good. Come on. He's like 32. I think he's playing in Mexico now. We brought him back now, I think he'd do a job. I still think he's going to do it. He just... I think there's something, and he's had quite a good, you know, he did quite well for LA Galaxy. I think he'd done all right for Mexico. And there was that whole thing about, I think Redknapp said he was like lazy and he always turn up late on Mondays, and he was always slightly overweight, I think. And you could tell I love a Tourette, you know, like a player. I love to see someone just waste their natural talent. I love to see them throw it away, you know. I really thought he was going to, yeah, change everything.
It just, even his name, he just sounded like the sort of mercurial, you know, foreign talent that you can absolutely put your everything. I mean, Giovanni Dos Santos is like, if you had to sort of generate a player name to get excited about, he was it. And he had his moments, didn't he? There was those occasional flashes in like a right in a Europa qualifier or something, or an early round of a league cup.
He'd score against Shakhtar Donetsk. Exactly.
You'd be like, oh wow, this is it. It's finally happening. This is it now. And then, that's a good answer. Giovanni, I think, captures so much of what, you know, and probably Rebrov as well. It's interesting. You've commemorated Sergei's first career on film now, which is someone that does not deserve that in the slightest. But perhaps depending on the character's nature, maybe he does deserve it. Next question. Your matchday ritual. So you live down in Brighton now, Joe. So I imagine game to games is a wee bit tricky, etc.
Yeah.
How do you like to enjoy or endure watching Spurs? what's an experience? And also, you know, when you do go to games, how do you like to do it?
Well, yeah, so I'm mostly a sort of lazy armchair fan. My match day ritual, the match day ritual, often the day begins by basically a sort of series of negotiations with my other half, who does not care for football and doesn't particularly want my. So I got two kids. I got a 10-year-old and a 4-year-old, two boys. And the 10-year-old is like dangerously obsessed with Tottenham. Lives for them. I've really done a number on him and loves football. The 4-year-old could take it or leave it. Actually, the 4-year-old keeps saying he's going to support Arsenal because that's just his personality. Just fuck with me.
If he actually continues to push that sort of callous agenda, what would you do as a dad?
Well, I'll love him less. I'll just love him less. What else can I do? There'll be a clear thing. You know when people are like, oh, you can never choose your favourite kid? Well, solves that, doesn't it? we'll see. We'll have to see. I'm trying to get him some sort of Spurs sort of memorabilia and stuff. I'm trying to push the agenda. I think he's still young. He can still be moulded. He can still ruin his life. The match day experience is essentially building up to the football's on later, so hoping we could watch it, you know, so maybe have to go for a nice walk in the morning, maybe have to do so, you know what I mean, do something with the family to buy the opportunity to then sit on the sofa watching it. But there's sort of, I do have one sort of little ritual, which is that I have a Tottenham mug, and it's a lucky mug, but I have discovered it's not lucky if I drink out of it, it's only lucky if my girlfriend drinks out of it. But I can't go to her and say, here's your coffee, you have to drink out of the Spurs mug. And she doesn't like the Spurs mug because we've got lots of very nice sort of, you know, fancy sort of, you know, fancy mugs that she likes. So doesn't like the Spurs mug, but I have to engineer a situation without her knowing it to get her to drink out of the Spurs mug. And only then is it lucky. That's why the other day against Liverpool, managed it, 2-2 draw. I think it speaks for itself. So I have to sort of do the thing with the mug. I have to.
Can you talk me through how you did manage to essentially trick her into taking a sip from a piece of crockery she didn't want to sip from?
You just got to get in there early, man. You got, when it's got to be that early in the morning, that, you know, when someone hands you a coffee, you drink it if it came in a
bottle. Gotcha.
You know what I mean?
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, really, yeah. So it's just
the element of surprise. Okay, yes. Good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Necessity. And so there's that. And then, but in the sort of match day rituals, I've taken my kid a couple. My son has such a warped view of what it is to go and watch Tottenham live. And we've been like 4 or 5 times, and we've won every time by like quite a significant margin. So I think the first thing was like the 4-0 against Everton. We went to see the 5-4 against Leicester. There was like a 3-0 against Crystal Palace. He's like, I think he is the lucky charm. Maybe it's not the mug. Maybe it's him. But yeah, I mean, there's no sort of routine. It's just like, get to London on time. try and get him to eat something. Try and get him to just calm down and stop, you know, shouting. But yeah, so we were going to go and see the Brighton Tottenham game because we got tickets to see the Brighton fans. But I know my kids, he just talks constantly through the whole game as well. Like, getting him to not reveal that we were undercover Spurs fans would have been impossible. I mean, Brighton's a pretty chill out. I don't think we'd have got, you know, attacked or anything, but it would have been tricky.
Do you still get affected massively if Spurs lose? Have you managed to sort of mellow over the years?
It does really affect me. It really affects my mood. I mean, again, it depends on the context of the game and, like, and also the context of, like, where we are. I think I was numb by the end of, like, Mourinho. I never got numb for Nuno because he wasn't there long enough. So I was still sort of apoplectic with rage. Yeah, man. It can be a real day. It can be a real week, Bruno. I'm sort of worried about the sort of, if we do play just before Christmas and if we do play West Ham, it's like, fuck, I just hate them. So yeah, man. And then that sort of, because obviously, like, my partner again, he's like, it's just football, and you have to explain why A, you've carved 2 hours out of the day to watch, and then why you're then in a filthy mood for the rest of the evening. People don't understand, they don't care.
I think it's worse as well, like being sort of sentient to why it's ridiculous. Yeah. I wish I was just like, you know, I wasn't aware of how ludicrous I was being sometimes. Yeah. And I couldn't see my wife's point of view, because obviously I totally can, you know, see her, like, exasperation when I'm, like, harumphing around the house after a defeat. Yeah. On a Sunday after we've had a really lovely weekend and it's now up in smoke because, you know, yeah, Harry Kane's not scored or whatever. So it's sort of worse when you're, like, left to, you know, it's almost out of body for me sometimes, where I'm like, why are you sulking?
Yeah,
like,
this
is awful.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is our plight.
Yeah, you can't control it.
Speaking of plights, I'd like your, well, actually, no, that's not the right question for that terrible seg. I've jumped to question. Your favourite all-time Spurs shirt, Joe?
This is a slight sort of adaptation of this question, because it's my favourite Spurs shirt, but really it's my favourite Spurs socks, if I could be so bold.
You can.
2008, do you remember those hooped socks?
The stripies, yeah, yeah.
I loved them. Everyone else hated them. I remember really loving that, and it was I was a full kit wanker. I did have the whole kit. I didn't have the shorts, actually. I had the top and I had the socks. I didn't normally get the socks, but I just liked the socks, so I had them. I just thought we looked great in them, and I used to wear, and the shirt's like it's a very basic home shirt. It was Mansion, but it was that season where they had Mansion. They had a bunch of other writing underneath it. They went the full, like, mansion.com gambling a bit or whatever, the whole thing. And it's pretty sort of plain shirt. But I used to play five-a-side in Islington, and I used to wear that shirt, and I would just, you know, get pelters on Upper Street, walk it like Thursday evenings, I get dogs abuse every Thursday night, walking around Upper Street in my Spurs kit. But then that was the kit that David Bentley scored that ridiculous goal against Arsenal. I remember watching in an Arsenal pub as well, and it was great. And again, David Bentley's, he was another of those players, actually, that I really thought was gonna. He was a bit of a Giovanni dos Santos for me. So I was, oh yeah, brilliant! And he did that, and it was brilliant. And but I just have happy memories of that kit and playing five-a-side in it, and being able to sort of get one back on my Arsenal friends. It's an amazing goal.
Where do you stand on sort of the current climate for very jazzy away kits and planet exploding? Jazz.
Yeah. I like it, man, actually. I didn't think I would, but I really like the away kit. I can see you know what the meeting was when they decided that. Like, my kid loves it, and his friends who support Tottenham, and not many of them, but, like, a couple of them. The kids, younger people, basically, sound old just saying, but you can imagine they sat there with a whiteboard being like, what do young people like? And lots of colours. And it does seem like it's sort of an attempt to sort of do something, but I really like it. I don't like the third kit. I think that's
a step too far. Yeah, that's, I don't know if we needed two sort of kid-friendly,
yeah,
paint explosion kits. Like, yeah, although I suppose the home shirt is so straightforward this season that perhaps they felt they could go wild. But
well, the home shirt is really dull. Last season's I really liked. I had that sort of blue.
Oh, really?
Shoulders. Yeah, so I was a fan. I don't know. I feel like maybe my kit sort of preferences are out of whack with other people. But I really like last season's. But
well,
yeah,
kits,
I mean,
you know, it's a very personal thing. I think, you know, it's like asking someone for their, you know, what's your favorite? Who's your favorite band? It's entirely your preference. There's no wrong answer. And kits are the same as it.
The hoops.
The hoops. Oh, it's nice to remember those. I was sort of gutted because Arsenal have hoop socks this season, and I remembered our hoop socks and got a bit jealous.
Yeah.
So maybe they're due a comeback. These things always come back around.
Well,
they can commemorate that glorious season of one day Ramos being sacked and Redknapp saving us from relegation.
Yes.
Beautiful times. Speaking of beautiful times, yes. Much better seg actually. Your Spurs heaven and your Spurs hell. So it doesn't have to be a specific game. It can just be an era, a period, a signing of a player, something to do with a specific manager, sort of good and bad.
Okay, so my Spurs heaven and my Spurs hell. Well, they're sort of like connected games, connected by the scoreline. And again, it's like, this is a bit like saying Bale's your favourite player. It's like quite, it's a really obvious Spurs heaven. But the semi-final, the Ajax game, the Friel draw, and I watched that in a pub in Brixton, and obviously it was going very badly at half time, and I was out with some friends, and I took some I took some mood enhancers at half time. Can you describe? And they started to kick in around the time that we started scoring. And by the time the last goal went in, I was on a different plane of existence, quite literally. I don't think I'll ever be that happy again. On a chemical level, I don't think I can be that happy again. Absolutely.
I mean, that's a pretty potent combination, right? I mean, how do you emulate that? I don't know that you can.
I don't think you ever can. The circumstances will almost certainly never come up again. And I just sort of, I mean, I was happy for days and couldn't sleep a lot, but like, I just, yeah, man. And it was, I mean, even in and of itself, like, and again, it's that feels such an obvious game, but there's no, what greater sort of moment could you have than that game, even if you remove any sort of outside elements, just like, well, euphoric. But it was, out of this world. And you know, even with the sort of the final didn't go very well. Mm-hmm. I'm almost like, obviously, it would have been brilliant, unreal to have won it. But that semi-final, like it's that sort of thing of like, you know, when you're old and looking back on like being a fan of a certain team, those moments in and of themselves, they're still worth it, even if they didn't. You know, people always show that, was it Ledley King doing that amazing sliding challenge against Chelsea? Is it, I can't remember.
Robin, yeah.
Yeah, and then they scored from that corner, right?
Yeah.
But no one ever, you know, remembers, look at that amazing, Ledley King was fucking good. You know, and it's a bit, you know, I think in years to come, we'll probably look at the Lamella Rabona against Arsenal. Brilliant. And then forget that we lost that game. But yeah, I mean, so it was amazing. It was just incredible. And the sort of flip side of that, the Spurs hell, was it where we've mentioned it already, but it was the West Ham game with where we threw away. And it was, what was it, 3-0, was it? We threw away that we'd been playing so well. And Bale came on. I think, I mean, I have such a terrible memory in my head. I'm like, were they both free all games? I think they were. But Bale came on. I think his first kick was, he came on and took a free kick with his first kick or something like that. He did something. And it was, yeah. And it was really, like you said, that was a really tame free kick. And then he almost scored and he didn't. And then we threw it away. And it was just that. And it was a pandemic on. It's still a pandemic on. And it was just, it was really, that was a low point.
And it seemed like, I know obviously the Mourinho era in general was pretty bleak, but I feel like up until that point, we hadn't been quite so ultra conservative and Mourinho didn't have the handbrake fully on. But then after that, he was like, I cannot trust these morons. We're just going to have to like stick sort of 9 men behind the ball, have Son and Kane up front and just hope that they can do something. And it just became so dull almost overnight. And I sort of understood, because that was like the most ridiculous sort of 10 minutes of like amateur hour football I've ever seen Spurs play, I think.
So, but
yeah, it seemed to sort of then we just became this like really dull team that was always, and then it was always going to end badly.
It was this, and then it was a sort of, I can't remember if that was before or after sort of the, that sort of that we'd go 1-0 up against like Palace and Wolves, and then you know let them equalize the lot. And that was the worst thing, where you were dreading scoring a goal because you knew you were going to kill the game. Yeah, bad times.
That takes me through to the last of our seven questions. Where are you with Spurs right now, Joe?
I feel like probably a lot of people. I feel really good at the moment. I feel really probably not even that cautiously optimistic, hubristically optimistic. Come back and bite me. We've got an incredible manager, and I think you've seen like, you know, you've seen what the difference of good coaching has done to players. A lot of people have written off, you know, I mean, Harry Winks just, you know, was brilliant against Liverpool, you know, and you players like him, Eric Dier, you know, has been immense, and you know, and it's so, I mean, it's still sort of early days, and it's been a very you know, interrupted, and we've missed, you know, had to postpone a lot of games, and we'll see what happens. But it does seem like you can see the footprint of something going forward. Like you know, the quality of coaching with these players, they're good players. Maybe they still need to be sold or whatever. But you know, Delhi or you know, just being, you know, you see that sort of flashes of what they were. So I feel really optimistic. You know, I don't know. I feel like we have definitely put ourselves in the place where top four doesn't feel, you know, laughable, which it did just a couple of weeks ago. So
it's just nice to see a plan, isn't it? Just actually watching a Spurs team where you can see a clear idea of what's supposed to happen. Whereas I feel like we've had 2 years of just sort of sleepwalking through games, and or the only plan being, like you say, score and then hope that you don't crumble at the last minute away at Wolves or whatever. So actually seeing, player improvement and an actual formation that seems to work, it's kind of incredible. And also just the, you know, it's cliche to talk about this with Conte, I think, but just that injection of passion and enthusiasm is infectious. And I think, you know, the fans are responding to almost being sort of like, you know, we've been given a kick up the arse, I think, by having this sort of guy here where, you know, we do have this sort of natural, you know, kind of nihilistic view of Spurs matches a lot of the time. And I think I almost get the impression that he can sense that, and he's like, stop it. Like, stop this whole like, oh, we'll concede in the last minute because it's Spurs. Like, I think he knows it's his job to almost like, sort of build fans into a different type of fan as well, if that's at all possible.
Yeah, this is changing the whole sort of culture at the club, sort of at all levels. Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, he's not there to let in last minute equalisers. And you see with that you know Conference League game that we lost, like you just got the sense that he was just like, no, this isn't going to happen. Like, get this out of your system now. Yeah, it's just not what he does. So that I hope so. Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Awesome. Those are the seven questions. The last question we ask everyone, Joe, is for a culture recommendation from you. It can be anything, an album, a TV show, a film, a book, an exhibition, a restaurant you've enjoyed, anything at all. So what you got for us?
A culture recommendation is a show called Landscapers on Sky, which is, full disclosure, it's directed and made by friends of mine, but so it's directed by Will Sharp, who played Rodney in Giri Haji, and it's the same producers and all that. But it's a really incredible piece of work, Olivia Colman and David Fulis, and it's an exploration of a true crime, a true crime story. This couple that were arrested for the character that Olivia Colman plays, her parents were found buried in the back garden, and they were arrested and charged with the killing of at least one of them. But it's an exploration of that, but it's also exploration of just how we interact with memory and truth and the nature of the past and how we tell true crime stories and our interest in them and all this dialogue and formulae, I don't know, is that the word I want? It's made in a really interesting way. The format of it is fascinating. He uses different, you know, cameras and aspect ratios and these techniques, building sets that you know that you're looking at a set, or sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. And the sound is, everything is very, experimental makes it sound like it's not sort of structured. It then knows exactly what it's doing, but it's a very, it's just a very auteured and confident piece of work. So that's on Sky Atlantic, I think, or Now TV.
Mm. Yeah. It's really beautiful, isn't it? I wasn't expecting to be quite so moved by it. I wasn't expecting to be just left really sort of taking in such beautiful photography, and like you say, the different aspect ratios, the different, the ways it sort of harks back to old periods of filmmaking, and you know, the couple's obsession with sort of old Hollywood, etc., and French film is amazing. Yeah, really recommend it. And I think a lot of people perhaps go into it expecting one thing. Probably it sort of takes 10 minutes to sort of wrap your head around that. You're watching something altogether very different, but yeah, Will has no business being that talented a filmmaker and actor. It's just disgusting.
It's unreasonable. He's just a really nice guy as well. It's just sort of, yeah, sickening.
A good recommendation. I would, yeah, also gets mine. Joe, that was wonderful. Thank you so much for answering all my slightly sycophantic Gary Hadji questions. all of my Spurs questions that we have. And being such good company, I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you ever so much for your time. And yeah, best of luck with what sounds like a really thrilling 2022 as well. We're looking forward to all that work.
Thanks, man. Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Very welcome. That was a Joe Barton Hometown Glory special episode. I'm Charlie, and thank you very much for tuning in. Goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.